This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up later, we'll listen back to a conversation with a Hartford-based guitarist, originally from Puerto Rico, who celebrates the music of her home country while also exploring the classical repertoire. But first, when you watch just a few moments of the TV, radio, web program, Democracy Now!, it might look like just another talking head show filling up time in the 24-hour cycle, but then you watch and listen to what's really happening.
76 indiscriminate rockets fired at our kids, fired at our old people, fired at our women.
But could you respond to this issue of the deaths?
Yes, ma'am.
You've got over 100 Palestinians who've now been killed.
First of all, I've already said that for Israel, any civilian death is not only a tragedy, but it's a failure as well.
That's from a recent program examining the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That style presenting real debates between those with conflicting views and presenting some voices not often in the mainstream media has gotten host Amy Goodman a large following among those who think the rest of the media landscape has gotten too corporate. Regular topics include the Edward Snowden revelations about spying and regular coverage of war and conflict. Goodman will be at the Mark Twain House and Museum tonight to discuss her book, The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope. She joined us in conversation last week. Amy Goodman, welcome to Where We Live.
It's great to be with you.
So this idea of the silenced majority, this book you wrote back in 2012, it seems in many ways as though this idea of a silent majority or a silenced majority is even more resonant than it was even when you started to write this book. Maybe you can describe to our listeners what you mean by this. Who are you describing?
Well, you know, I really do think that those who are deeply concerned about what's happening, not only in this country, but in the world, the whole issue of war and peace, the growing inequality in the United States between rich and poor, the issue of climate change, you know, the fate of the planet, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. That's very much what we are going to be talking about at Mark Twain House, what we talk about in The Silenced Majority. It's giving voice to the people at the grassroots in this country and around the world.
And the people in this country who are part of the grassroots, I think it's fair to say, even if they are silenced in many ways by a corporate media, it's quite a bit different than what happens around the rest of the world. I think often, Amy Goodman, we in America take for granted the fact that we have so much access to a free press. We have so much access to information. In a lot of ways, this silenced majority in the rest of the world is really a bigger part of the problem. So many people have no access to any information at all.
Well, access to information is critical. But, you know, in this country, when we look at the access to information we have, we live in a globalized world, but we are so insulated when it comes to getting information, even here in the most powerful country on earth. Let me give you an example. In the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, and we're very much looking back at Iraq now because of what's happening there, the group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, did a study of the four major nightly newscasts like 6 weeks before the U.S. invasion, like February 5th, 2003, the day Secretary of State Colin Powell gave his speech for war at the United Nations. A speech he would later call a stain on his career, you know, where he asserted, we now know that Saddam Hussein actually has weapons of mass destruction, something he was very sorry for, Colin Powell later, that speech, because it was so seminal in pushing for war. So FAIR looked at the NBC Nightly News, CBS Evening News, ABC World News Tonight, and the PBS NewsHour in the 2 weeks around that speech. And there were 393 interviews done around war. This was at a time when I'd say the population was sort of very divided about whether to go to war with Iraq. 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war leaders, three of almost 400. That's no longer a mainstream media. That's an extreme media beating the drums for war. And this really matters. Because when the media simply repeats the words of power, you know, at that time it was the Bush administration, and when they're not telling the truth, the lies take lives. I mean, even the Times, you know, more than a year later, the New York Times, which had on its front page over and over those stories by people like Judith Miller and Michael Gordon alleging weapons of mass destruction based on unnamed sources. The Times did a story a long time later. I think it was on page A12 called The Times in Iraq. And it was about how they got it wrong. But they didn't name their reporters' names. I think, you know, people called it their mea culpa. I called it their kinda culpa. They needed that box on the front page of the Times as many times as those false stories appeared, because that's what sinks into the consciousness of the American people. So I'm concerned when we live here at the trigger end of the gun, you know, certainly when it came to Iraq, that we have that full access, that we hear all of those voices, the spectrum of opinion, especially at a time when a country is making the most important decision a country can make, and that is whether to go to war.
So what is behind that, do you think? Why, in that instance, did we not hear more voices?
Well, you know, I call it the axis of evil, right? We know about the axis of evil, that the term that George Bush coined, referring to whatever, North Korea and Iran, et cetera. But you look at the reporters that go to the White House, and I covered the White House for years and the press conferences that happen. There's a kind of understanding, I guess you could say, a kind of protocol. And reporters want to be able to ask the president or the vice president a question. So you throw softball questions so you can get your answer from the person, you know, himself, and you go back to your newsroom, and that is great for your career. But I think we have to ask the very serious, tough questions all the time. Politicians need journalists more than journalists need politicians. You know, we have a special responsibility. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. And this has to do with whether we're covering a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. You know, I've written a few books with my brother, also a journalist in Vermont, David Goodman, and my colleague, Dennis Moynihan. The book Silence Majority is my book of columns we do for King Features that I write with him every week. And my brother, David, we wrote The Exception to the Rulers. I think that should be the motto of all the media, not just Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. And our second book is called Static. And the reason we call it that is even in this high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, still all we get is static, that veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality, when what we need the media to give us is the dictionary definition of static, criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history.
You know, and obviously, we've heard some of these criticisms before, both from the right and the left. Liberal groups have long said that mainstream news organizations are too conservative, too close to their advertisers, certainly, and the seats of power, and they collude to keep certain voices out of the news. Meanwhile, of course, conservative groups say that those same organizations are led by liberals who use their editorial power to exclude certain voices and are part of a quote-unquote media conspiracy. I will just say, having been in the media as you have for quite some time, Amy, you know, journalists in many ways aren't coordinated enough to actually have some sort of a conspiracy to do anything or the other. What do you think's really at work here? Is it really, as you say, just people trying to keep their jobs, asking softball questions at the White House? Is there something deeper? Is there some sort of, in your mind, a media conspiracy to keep certain voices out of the news?
John, I agree with you. I don't think it is a conspiracy. I think it's a shared consensus. You know, it's not the president calling up the editor and saying, I don't want this, and I don't want this covered, right? I think it is the feeling journalists have of what will make you rise in your career and what won't. You know, if you're there saying, hey, I want to go out and cover the protests in the streets, and, you know, someone says, okay, now what other stories are we going to do? And you realize that gets you marginalized. You don't tend to go in that direction. And especially, look at the issues we're dealing with today. You know, I just came back from a week of broadcasting in Germany and Sweden. We call it a broadcasting, like a broadcasting abroad. And we were following the nomads of the digital age. I'm talking about Edward Snowden, Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, and I ended up in Britain on Independence Day weekend interviewing Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And you think about what happened when Edward Snowden came out with his revelations through journalists, Laura Poitras, the filmmaker, and Glenn Greenwald. The two of them won the Pulitzer Prize with the news organizations The Guardian and The Washington Post. At the beginning, the way Edward Snowden was dealt with, this NSA contractor who, you know, left the United States, went to Hong Kong, and released all of these documents saying he believes he's a patriot, that he is a whistleblower, and how the media dealt with him. I'm not just talking about the politicians calling for his head, but pundits and journalists, or I call them sometimes on television, news personalities, saying how outrageous, he's endangering national security. Even the new head of the NSA has said he has not done this kind of damage to national security. And the New York Times came out many months later in an editorial saying, we are going to call him a whistleblower. I mean, think about what he found out and the global discussion he has launched around the issue of surveillance and wiretapping, monitoring of not only the American people. You know, I was watching the World Cup and the final games in Brazil, and I was looking at who was in the finals in that game. Who was in the audience? You had Dilma Rousseff. She's the president of Brazil. You had Angela Merkel. She's the chancellor of Germany, right, because it was happening in Brazil. And, of course, the Germans won the World Cup. These are two of perhaps among the most surveilled people in the world, we learned. Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, and this all came out from the Snowden documents, and Angela Merkel. So I was in Germany. They're having an inquiry right now around these revelations. In the United States, you know, it's turned things on their head. There is questioning in Congress what is happening right now. The American people are beginning to understand the level of surveillance. You have all these people, including journalists, saying, you know, it's not like he's some kind of Dan Ellsberg, the man who released the secret history of U.S. Involvement in Vietnam and helped to end the Vietnam War. But you have Ellsberg himself who's saying, no, I think Edward Snowden is me and more what he has done. And it was the attitude of journalists as well. Journalists, more than anyone, should understand how serious a threat it is to democracy to have this level of surveillance, even of our own news organizations. Remember when the revelations came out that the Obama administration had tapped 20 of the phones of the Associated Press used by 100 reporters and editors on Capitol Hill?
Of course.
I mean, when journalists are threatened, it's not only a threat to freedom of the press. It is a threat to the public's right to know. And that's why we all have to protect it.
We're talking with Amy Goodman. She's host and executive producer of Democracy Now! She'll be at the Mark Twain House and Museum tonight to discuss her book, The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope. You can find out more information about her appearance at marktwainhouse.org. And this is where we live. Actually, talking about Ellsberg and Snowden in that same breath leads me to the next question for Amy Goodman. And it really comes to who we in the media should be going to, in your mind, to hear from. As you may or may not know, I live just down the street from Ralph Nader, somebody who I know that you know well. And he and I talk quite a bit about some of these very same issues. And I asked him once on stage, actually, who's the next Ralph Nader? Who's the guy who will pick up the baton from you? And he was somewhat cynical about it because he feels as though many people of his generation have decided to take a big paycheck or write a big book and not really step into his shoes. And I think that's really the main point. Many, many people who get into politics who espouse one point of view are there because they want to stay in politics for quite a long time. But if you look down the list of people who might speak against a surveillance state or might speak against a war, you have an Edward Snowden, you have a Ralph Nader, and frankly, Amy Goodman, within public consciousness, we don't have a whole lot of other people to turn to.
Well, I don't think it's about an individual. I think it's about movements. and giving voice to movements in this country that are deeply concerned about what's happening. Whether we're talking about the issue of war and peace, whether we're talking about, for example, climate change, there are many leaders. You know, with Democracy Now!, our news hour, every year since 2009, we've gone to the UN Climate Summit, you know, from Copenhagen to Cancun, from Durban to Doha. We were in Warsaw, Poland this past year. And you might say, why waste the fuel? What gets accomplished at these UN summits? And we broadcast every day for an hour, our full broadcast. Well, it's not so much what happens inside. It's what happens outside, and it's what happens in the hallways. Thousands of people, remarkable young and older voices, deeply concerned about climate change, about the fate of the planet, and about the fact that we can control it. This is not some natural phenomenon that we don't have a hold on and we all just have to face it together. We can do something about it. The eloquence, the brilliance, the strategizing that goes on— these are voices that we don't usually hear, that we turn to. And I think it is when the media respects movements, not isolated in their, you know, sort of hallowed hallways, very isolated, corporate-funded by their advertisers, but really committed to getting out in the streets and seeing what people are doing. There are a myriad of voices all over the world, people who are risking their professions, their livelihoods, their very lives to try to make the world a better place. So I'm very hopeful. When people get information, it really matters. And that's what I'm most hopeful about. That's why I am very hopeful after Edward Snowden, that the walls are being pushed down, that people are hungry for unfettered information, and they want to live in an open and free society. In our country, we can determine that society. It's not about making a particular decision on, you know, going a certain way, but fighting for a more open society where people can make a decision about what we want our country to represent in the world.
Of course, one of the important things about that is that movements are, by their nature, messy. They're not necessarily always headed in one particular direction. In America, one of the criticisms of the Occupy movement was that it wasn't really just about one thing, and so, therefore, it didn't get its message across as clearly as it could have. Clearly, you can take a look at what happened with the Arab Spring, even in Egypt. A movement to overflow a dictatorial government ends up in a place where maybe we have some of the same problems that we did a few years later. That is hard for the press to cover, but it's pretty clear, Amy Goodman, that we should be digging in to look at these movements, even though they're not necessarily headed in a direction that has a very clear trajectory.
I mean, for sure, the Occupy movement changed the world. There's no question about that. You know, all the ways it will manifest itself, we can't predict. But September 17th, 2011, when thousands of people, you know, marched on Zuccotti Park, yes, the encampments were pretty much eviscerated by the police, not only in New York, but around the country. But it's not just the physical encampments. They changed the language. Now, if you say 99%, everyone in this country and many people all over the world understand what you mean. You talk about the 1%. People understand what you mean. Occupy, the word itself. Where it will go, we will only see. But it's, I think, changed consciousness of people at the top and on the bottom. And when it comes, for example, to Egypt, I mean, you're right. There was the Arab Spring, and people rose up and they overthrew a dictator who had been in power, Mubarak, for decades. What happens now? You know, you have the election of Mohamed Morsi, then he's overthrown in a coup by a general, General Sisi, and he is clamping down on the press and on activists and dissidents like we haven't seen before. It's very frightening. It is our job to be there on the ground to speak to people because it's movements that really make history. And so often those voices are not heard. I think about Dr. King. April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated, he was here in New York at Riverside Church giving his speech opposed to the war. He was slammed by the major media in this country, saying for everyone from Life magazine to other major newspapers, saying he had done a disservice to his cause and his people. He should stick to civil rights. Why is he taking on the Vietnam War? Even people in his inner circle said, you know, Martin, don't do this. You got the president around your finger. You got the Voting Rights and the Civil Rights Act passed in 64 and 65. Don't take on this war. It's not your war. And he said, no. He said, these are all part of a seamless web, and I care about justice. When Martin Luther King was going around the country, he was often slammed by the press. He was often not heard as he would, slog his way through the mud to visit, let's say, Joan Baez in a prison because she was protesting the war. But when you follow people in these movements, you know, these are the people who are making history, who will determine the future.
A last question for you then. I mean, we have been talking quite a bit 50 years on from the Civil Rights Act and the major developments of the civil rights movement of the mid-1960s. You said a moment ago that you are hopeful. What do you think has changed in the way America looks at whether it's, as you put them, uprisings, occupations, resistance? Has much changed in the way we view that? Do you think that young people today can be as energized to perhaps make change as they were in 1964?
I think there's no question about it. I think liberal and conservative lines are breaking down. There is a reality on the ground. People are suffering. You know, there is the greatest disparity between rich and poor that we have seen in decades, perhaps that we've ever seen in this country. And I think that people care. People care about corporate control. They care about issues of privacy. People care when they know. And that's why it's so important to express what's happening, to enable, to provide a platform for people to speak for themselves and describe their own realities instead of what we get in the major networks. You know, you see the small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. Whether we're talking about Israel and the Palestinian territories, or we're talking about Iraq right now, or we're talking about civil and human rights in the United States, I think people are more similar than they are different. And we have to get our microphones out there, our cameras pointed in the direction where it matters, where there is more common ground, I think, throughout this country than certainly we see reflected in Washington.
Amy Goodman is host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, which is on the radio, it's on television and the web. She will also be in person at the Mark Twain House and Museum tonight to discuss her new book, The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope. Find out more information at marktwainhouse.org. Amy Goodman, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next, we'll hear some music and we'll have some conversation with the Puerto Rican guitarist Joviana Garcia. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Joviana Garcia grew up in Puerto Rico, fascinated by the sound of the guitar and its role in the music of that country. Her training took her solidly into the world of concert classical guitar repertoire, but her latest projects take her both back to her roots and into some new territories. She joined us in our Studio 3 to talk about her music and her ties back home, but she also played us some music. Thank you. That's Joviana Garcia here on Where We Live. Thank you so much for coming in. That's a beautiful piece.
Thanks for having me, John.
Could you tell us about what we just heard?
So we heard a piece by Puerto Rican composer Héctor Hernández, a former teacher of mine, and it's called Lucero del Mar, which means Little Star of the Sea. And he is a phenomenal guitarist and guitar teacher, and he decided to use a lot of interesting guitar resources like harmonics and chords to evoke that little star shining over the sea waves that come and go. So,
and it's a very beautiful piece. I'm wondering what else you can tell us about that composer, because I think one of the things we want to talk about is the music of Puerto Rico, which you feature. And I don't think people know much about Puerto Rican classical composers. Can you talk about this composer and about this world that you're maybe opening up to us?
Yes. So this composer, as I mentioned before, was a former teacher of mine. And he had the classical guitar training in actually the same school that I ended up going to. And but in spite of being trained classically, he would compose using folk elements in the guitar. And many other composers in Puerto Rico, like, for instance, Ernesto Cordero, Dan Román, who lives here in Hartford, and other composers that I play, have that classical training, but they are doing this work to try to preserve and innovate our folk music genres and traditions. So I have always been inclined to do the same, and it's hit me a lot stronger since I moved here to Hartford, Connecticut.
Why do you think it's hit you more since you moved to Hartford?
I guess because I've had the chance to share with people that have moved here from Puerto Rico and from different parts of Latin America. I've also been very active at the Church of the Good Shepherd community, who has a bilingual community. And I've observed that a lot of people are not aware of our history, of where we come from and who we are. And I think it's so important that at least it has been for me to know who you are, where you came from. It makes you more aware of where you are and what are you supposed to do. What's your role in this society? And I feel that it's my duty to use what I have and my training to take that message. And I guess it's hit me more here since I've been away from home, and sometimes when you're away from home, you get to appreciate more who you are and where you came from. So, I think that's why.
Well, tell me about home. Where exactly do you come from?
I was born and raised in Ponce, Puerto Rico, which is a south coast town, I've been very close to my family, and my family is a musical family. So my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt are all trained musicians, and so it's no wonder that I'm doing the same thing. And then I did my undergrad in the Conservatory of Music in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Then I did my master's here. But during my childhood and teenage years, I was always into music. I was always filled with classical music experiences as well as folkloric music experiences from my family and the schools that I was lucky to study. And I guess all of that shaped me, and my classical training just refined a lot of things, and here I am.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the folk music of Puerto Rico that influences you. Years ago, I worked with the Institute of Community Research to do a series of recordings of folk musicians from around the world who'd gathered here in Connecticut, who lived here and made their home here. Mm-hmm. And we featured some musicians who specialized in Jíbaro music and in folk music of the hills of Puerto Rico. And mm-hmm. one of the things they told me was that sometimes their friends, when they were growing up, would say, "What are you listening to? That's old people music.
Yeah.
that's farmer music. That's music from another time.
That's not cool.
Maybe you ran into some of this yourself. Could talk a little bit about your love of the folk music of Puerto Rico.
I was fortunate enough to see that kind of people did not really fit into my life. So I think I was always convinced of what I needed to do, and that's a blessing. But I was always exposed to it. I do remember always being inclined to listen to oldies and having friends of mine say exactly the same thing. But I think what made the difference was just the community that surrounded me, my family, particularly being so, again, of trained musicians and folkloric music oriented as well. And also, I was so lucky to study in music schools apart from my high school at the same time. So I was very tied to this musical community that was performing folk music all the time and also classical music. I think just the people that surrounded me and like reinforced my conviction to preserve it.
We were talking with the guitarist Joviana Garcia. She's playing some music from her home country of Puerto Rico. And let's hear another piece. Maybe you can tell us what we're going to hear next.
So next, we're going to hear one of the most important folk music genres of Puerto Rico, which you were talking about a little bit. In this case, we're going to hear a danza puertorriqueña, a Puerto Rican dance, and it's called El Coqui. And El Coqui is a little frog that we have, and it sounds like this. So the piece quotes it a lot. And the danza comes from the mix of the Cuban contra dance and even European contra dances. And we ended up adapting it as our own sophisticated music genre. So here it is, a Puerto Rican dance called El Coqui.
Talking with Puerto Rican guitarist Joviana Garcia. When we come back from our break, we'll hear more music and talk about her very unusual-looking guitar. You can see photos of it and get more information about her upcoming gigs at our website. It's WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're listening back to a conversation I recently had with Joviana Garcia. She's a Hartford resident who was born and raised in Puerto Rico. She's bringing her home country's music to a new audience here. If you'd like to find out more about her upcoming shows and to see a video of her performing, visit our website, WNPR.org. I'm wondering how much the music that is written by the composers that you play is really influenced by this very specific place with a specific topography, but also history. You talk about the European influences. You can see it there in the architecture and the art. You can certainly hear it in the music. Talk about how the music reflects just this place of this island.
So the music really portrays, just like you were saying, the topography, geography, and all the international influences, like you were talking about. There are many specific kinds of music that were grown and flourished in very specific areas. For instance, you have the all the bomba and plena and all the African genres that were predominantly present in the coasts, where the sugar industry was, where the sugar cane was, and where the African slaves would be working and surviving. The other example is the jíbaro music, or the country music. You would find that predominantly where the farmers were in the mountains. And the other kinds of music, for instance, like the very European-oriented music, was played like in more higher classes originally, which were the privileged people that could go to Europe and study and could have that contact with those genres. And then it was brought up to the rest of the people slowly. So we have the African, the European, we don't have a lot of indigenous music. We do have instruments, and we do have some records that they did have musical practices, but unfortunately, like most of Aboriginals in the rest of the Indies and North and South America, they were kind of exterminated.
Yeah, it was that was lost along with the people.
Yeah. So we don't have too much of that. And so I mentioned indigenous, African, European, and then we have all this influences by immigrants from other kinds, other places in Europe, other places in Latin America, and as a result, it's this mix of interesting music. Even in the own jíbaro music, we have different kinds of seises that are a reflection of that. So through history, we've adopted European aesthetics and tonality and that kind of stuff that was brought to us, but mixing it up with what we already had there, and particularly African music as well. So there's it's fascinating to me. I never stop studying it.
Well, I wonder too if there is a specific style of guitar playing, even classical guitar playing, that comes from Puerto Rico that's different. I mean, we think of the great Segovia and this Spanish sound of of what music sounds like, especially coming from a classical guitar. And much like you're both speaking Spanish, there's a very distinct dialect, a very distinct accent from Seville to San Juan. So I wonder if the guitar style itself is quite different.
Yes, actually. We have adopted the Spanish guitar and most of the technique through history. And we actually have made our own Spanish guitar-like instruments. But our own guitar style, it's very observable in jíbaro music accompaniment. So generally you would have these ensembles of the singer that's improvising all the time. And then you will have the cuatro, which is our national instrument. You will have some sort of percussion. And then the guitar's role in this folk music is to accompany with chords and do some of the bass lines.
Could you show us?
For example, you would have something. Something similar to that. This is more salsa-ish. Or if I were playing a danza, and stuff like that. So you would have these baselines that are going, coming and going, and then you would have the harmonic support. So the guitar's role is a little bit it's very particular. Yes.
And you have a very beautiful guitar. Could you describe it for people? It's an unusual design that I've not seen often.
So my guitar is made by Amherst luthier Alan Chapman, and this guitar is a classical guitar, since the construction, the body construction, and the dimensions and the strings are a classical guitar, but the sound hole is not in the middle of the guitar.
It's not just a single round sound hole as you would normally see.
Exactly. It's moved up towards the head of the guitar, like in the upper part of the body of the guitar, and it looks like two semicircles, one in the bottom and one in the top of the fretboard. So this model in particular is called the extended lattice bracing model. And what that is, if you're not familiar with the guitar, all the guitars have an inner structure under the top. And if you place a sound hole in the middle, there's only a small area in the bottom bout of the guitar that you can put that brazing, which is the structure responsible to spread the vibrations and make the guitar resonate. But Alan Chapman thought, well, maybe I can move up the sound hole and in the body of the guitar and extend that bracing and cover more of the top of the guitar and make it resonate more. And as a result, the guitar is 22% louder, and there's other kinds of overtones that happen.
It's beautiful to look at, but it makes sense, too. I understand that you're sort of increasing the resonance space in the guitar.
Yeah. I really like it. It's definitely very different sound from more traditional constructions.
So we're going to be hearing a little bit more music from Joviana in a moment. Is it pronounced Kaleidos?
Kaleidos.
Kaleidos.
Yes.
So Kaleidos, tell us about Kaleidos.
So Kaleidos is a collaboration that I have with Taiwanese percussionist Sayun Chang. And since we are both very, very adventurous musicians and we like to think outside the box, and we both like guitar and percussion, and we sing. We decided to come up with this world and contemporary music duo. So Sayun and I have been playing for a few years and touring a little bit. We actually just finished our DVD, which is coming up very soon. And we've been fortunate to create this pieces of music that evoke different styles of music from around the world, like Brazil, the Middle East, Argentina, Puerto Rico, Taiwan, and we've combined them with guitar, percussion, and we sing at the same time. So it's been great. It's been really interesting, and I think we're pretty unique.
Well, and it's so interesting, though, too, someone such as yourself who's so committed to keeping alive a very specific music, a very specific traditional music and mm-hmm. traditional sound, mm-hmm. but then at the same time you're so willing to reach out and say, let's see how this sounds if next to Arabic music or next to Taiwanese music.
Yeah, I'm a very, very open person. I believe that when you create art, when you make music, you can't close yourself to one thing because it's going to die eventually. So I like to preserve and innovate at the same time. And I found a musical partner that also likes to do the same thing. So even in the music that I perform in my solo concert, which is Puerto Rican guitar music, it's a mix of modern aesthetics as well. So It is not pure, and it can't be pure because even just look at the medium. It's just classical guitar, which is not a pure instrument, and we have all of these mixes. So
you're a modern person who lives in a modern place and
in a global society. So I really love it, and I love to preserve what I think is important to preserve and educate with it, but I'm also extremely open to learn from from others and innovate as well. So I think that's the key in this global society. And that's also some sort of message that I'm trying to convey with the music that I make.
Something you said before struck me a little bit. It's that even with the large Puerto Rican population here in the Hartford area, you feel that maybe there aren't people who know the history enough, that maybe there could be a little bit more knowledge of where you come from.
Yes, yes. And many people, and particularly the generations born here, they're not familiar with the kinds of music and the music's history that we have brought with us. So in my experience here, I found that even if people have an idea of the folk music that we have, they're not sure about how it got there in the first place and all the historical background, which says a lot of what we have endured and who we are. So that's why, that's why I took this, because it's like I really, really need to get this out there. People need to know. Mm. Again, it's just knowing yourself places you and gives you an idea of your role in your community.
Joviana Garcia is going to be performing the music of Puerto Rico, some of which we've heard today on the program. I really appreciate you joining us. This was so much fun.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. Thank you so much.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.